auch in meine Geschwindigkeit zu der Liebe hatte.
Ich bin im Kornel mit meinem Leben auf die Zähne.
Du bist am Ende, was du nicht hast.
The mission of the digital policies to sustainable development, to facilitating the community of skills for growth in the sector. That is our sector of and our strategic objective to prioritizing and communicating sector skills for sustainable growth, development and quickly in some kind in the sector, promoting and accelerating quality training for all in the workplace, promoting employability in sustainable livelihoods through skills development. Also assisting related groups, including the UN, participate in a second work in the Gated Learning and the Workplace Program to acquire sector skills to enter the labor market and self-employment. And improving the quality of labor and responsibilities, maximizing organizational performance and development. Jefferson has also just indicated that the slides are coming for this presentation as a way to do slides. Show the slides for the presentation. I think that they're definitely okay. They want to indicate the structure, current structure of the company, the future company.
Okay. We can wait
this is the current structure of the system, the government body, with the executive committee, the self-change of the government body, the functional training committees of the structure, with also the management committee of the structure, which is the three organizations manager, and also the chamber. This is also the structure of the speaker, which I think it's outlining the CEO and also the support structure within the CEO. But let me go straight to the highlights for this, but the highlights are for the target. It's also important to note that we do have the certification of validation of policies and procedures in terms of ISO international standards. Again, also we have the sort of what also says that the question is also the network forum, that is alliance network forum. We note that 1,000 artisans trade, but also very critical is also southern special industries associations. In fact, partnership with us, Christian women in the federal and oil industry project benefited. Within our own organization, it is the education training and development project assurance unit. Also, we have to note that the 3,000 learners were enrolled and 80% committed to this training. Once more, the 2,000 supported through the voucher scheme and also mandatory grants. Yeah, one small business, maybe one company, large or small, supported through monetary grant. Again, also to note in this meeting that science, engineering, and technology projects within the company, young school girls benefited from the project, those which enter the chemical sector. I'll just allow my CFO to outline the financial position of the company.
Thank you, Vasanda. Through you, Madam Chair. Just a few of the major highlights for the financial year. First, before I just get into that, I just want to, when you express the culture and the importance of the financial issues within CHITA, and what are our critical imperatives when it comes to financial management. I think the major issue of the CHITA is to ensure financial viability and sustainability. We live on the principles of effectiveness, efficiency, and economy in everything that we do. As a CHITA, due to the fact that we hold large funds in trust for employers while training cycles are occurring in the industry, we have to have a system of managing treasury, cash, and investment. I think another major area that we focus on is the effective, efficient, and transparent systems of financial risk management and internal control. For the year ended 2006-2007, the CHITA once again achieved the unqualified audit report, which indicates a clean bill of health. This unqualified audit report has been achieved for the past 6 years in a row, consistently, with no issues. We experienced an 18% increase in skills development levy income. The increase was from 155 million in the prior year to 182 million for the year ended March 2007. That was quite substantial because our levy income is based on payroll in the sector, and we estimated an average of about 6-7% increase in payroll in the sector, but our levy income substantially increased, meaning many companies joined the CHITA as the preferred supplier. In terms of the grant expenses, which is one of our core mandatory functions in terms of legislation, 81% of levy income received was paid out in grants. So that is quite a substantial amount. This graph basically depicts the disbursement of grants over the years since inception, from 2001 up until 2007. What can be seen is that the CHITA has consistently disbursed over 80% of its levy income in grants annually. We moved from 88% in 2001, going right up to 133% in 2006. The reason for the 133% disbursement was that there were a large accumulation of surpluses after the first NMCS cycle, that's up to 2005. And those surpluses were then utilized in 2006, and we paid out 161 million in that year, whereas we only received levy income of 135 million for grants. Current year, 2007, we've paid out 81% of our grant levy income, totaling an amount of 130 million. Just a split of how our grants are paid in terms of the companies in the sector. We've paid out grants to 121 large companies, 160 medium, and 151 small companies. The 121 large companies represent 100% of large companies in the sector. So we've achieved quite a high rate in that area. In terms of our grant disbursement by the chambers, I think Batandwa alluded to the various chambers that exist in the chemical sector. And this is a split of grants that we've paid out by the various chambers. And as you can see, we've paid out
FMCG, which is the fast moving consumer goods. We set up 88 companies in the FMCG, 139 petroleum and base chemicals, 25 in glass, 12 in explosives and fertilizers, and 167 in specialty chemicals. This makes the total of all the grants paid out across the various chambers. In terms of other major highlights, the total return on our invested fund for the year 2007 was at $8.5 million. The cheetah basically has a principle of investing in very low risk, non volatile investments in purely mostly in the money market. The reason for that is our view is that we hold this money in trust for employees, and it should not be exposed to any high risk. So we use the credit AA rated banks, and we have a policy which requires us to invest very conservatively to ensure a return in the region of 7 to 8%, but a guaranteed return so that the fund is not exposed to any additional risk. Total revenue, I explained that skills development revenue increased by 18%. Total revenue, including revenue from all other sources, this includes NSF, National Skills Authority, National Skills Fund revenue, increased by 26%, from 169 to 212 million. Total expenses, as a percentage of that revenue, was at 90%. In terms of the of other areas, I think there was a further, quite a large allocation during the financial year of surplus funds. 27 million of these funds, which we generated from administrative savings, investment income, unclaimed grants, were swept into discretionary reserves and for sector skills priority. So these are monies that are saved due to efficiencies in the financial management and across the operation. 27 million was achieved in terms of administrative savings, investment, and unclaimed grants. A further 35 million was allocated to discretionary grants for the 2007. We've further increased this by 10 million, which we've moved over, and so the total allocation for this year is now at 45 million. The employee compensation cost of the cheetah is at 50% of administration levy income. This decreased from 59% in the previous year. Meaning this is quite critical, because the amount we paid to payroll and personnel has decreased, yet we still managed to achieve all our targets within the financial year, which would show that the cheetah, that staff of the cheetah had a high morale and were working in much more areas in order, because the staff numbers had declined and there were less money allocated to payroll. The current assets to current liabilities, there was a ratio of 2.39 to 1 in 2006. This decreased to 1.87 to 1 in 2007. This basically means the coverage of our current assets to our current liabilities. In terms of a public sector company, this is a good result, because it means that the liabilities and assets, were paid out quite substantially during the year. There was a 50% increase in our current liabilities, from 63 million to 127 million. This was due largely to the additional mandatory grants that were allocated, as well as discretionary grants. Our total return on investment, I think I've covered that already.
In terms of the, when you come to the next reporting next cycle, what currently happening now, the youth is being approved by the board. And also we also do have a guide on make sure that we look at the cards and discuss this in terms of the data strategy. We intend to support the BFM supported by the Street of Plan. Also encourage the young learners to be trained and mentored, because what we want to make sure that we don't necessarily just train the learners, we also want to mentor them in this process. Also for identify provider institutions in access for new mentors, make sure that we identify the institutions that can provide new mentors to the learners. And also do the sector needs analysis. So that our sector is very diverse, but also want to make sure that we sort of identify the needs of the sector. And also to improve the wellness of in the process. What is also very critical for us is to make sure that the company, the financial performance of the company also continues to improve. But that will be supported by the very effective internal auditing and external auditing. But also very critical for this is to the whole issue of the compliance with the social and legislative framework. Because for this to perform in terms of the financial position, also supporting the young learners, we have to also comply with both our internal and also the broader framework of the country. Also, we have to make sure that our integrated system the implemented system within the company is also integrated, so that we capture all the relevant and also make sure that our performance of the company is at the acceptable standard through the integrated information system. But also very critical is also to the development of the web plan that also in line with our needs of our sector. Again, once more, it's the oldest issue of making sure that we also in line with the development of labor forecast. By that we mean that we take into account our external environment, our sector, specifically by our financial position, into account. So that's what it means that we have to apply the integrated approach in line with the forecast developed by Department of Labor. But also very crucial is also the whole issue of the international standards that we want to make sure that they are very in terms of the quality of system of local, the quality of our policies, the quality of our work within the CETA. Most importantly is to make sure that what we do within the CETA is we establish the memorandum of understanding with other industries within the sector. So that we don't do our work just in isolation, taking into account the external environment, identify the critical companies that we can draft with the memorandum of understanding with them, so that we can achieve the mission and the vision of our organization. Thank you.
Members who have been listening to the presentation,
Honorable Chair, when there's a straightforward report, it's what apparently is expected. All I want to check, does it mean the company out of this few years of operation, even it has not encountered some challenges, because I don't see challenges yet. Now, number two, given that you also inform us that you have received a clean bill of financial position, does it mean you never had rollover? Because you know, in the state agency, there's a good language of using savings when they have not used money allocated to them. So one together. Yeah. I think I'm also a champion member. Yeah, because this scorecard has developed by the World Code by the year. I think next time we invite you to explain to see that thing so that we can, this is not a hearsay. Yeah, good. That is the yardstick to measure the performance of the company. This balanced scorecard. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think maybe the questions I'm going to raise here, maybe it will be changed to the final, or maybe it will not according to the answer. The presentation was very brief. So I compare it with the challenges of change on the annual report. This one. So if we can please go to page 13, I have a question there. It says that the literacy and numeracy breakdown statistics. When I go through the provinces, I don't see the Northern Cape nowhere. If I can please have an explanation in relation to that. And then if we can
please... Can you add anything? Northern Cape or all other provinces
that are not added. Thank you, Chairperson, for the guidance there. And then, if we can go to place of the system, please, at the end there we have the lower bottom, the statistics are as follows: number of applications received in relation to bursary. That's the last three lines. It says that the number of applications received is 196, the number of applications approved, 43. Then why, if it's not 196 has been received, why so little? If you can have this explanation on that screen. And then page 34 on courses, second from the top courses, the biography. It says the mechanical engineering, the number of final approvals for chemical engineering was just one. If you can have some explanation there, please. And then page 36. The shutdown network forum, learners of statistics. It shows here that electricians. If we look at the breakdown on colored female, 0, get Indian female, 0, we get white female, 0, and disabled, 0, 0. Male and female. If we can have a breakdown on that too. And lower down at the regions where Honorable Gamela explained to me the people that work on the oil fields or around the oil areas. There we see that colored female 0, Indian male 0, Indian female 0, and then white female 0, and disabled 0, 0. If we can have an explanation on that, and the last page, on the chairperson, please, page 43. There on the cheetah service level agreement, there where we have also the target, and then we have achievement next. Then we see this row which says, like, if we go to areas like the number of blacks just below 2.7, you find number of blacks. I take as the word first row indicates the target for 2007, and then we see that it's 111. They started at 111, but when we look at the achievement, then we see that zero. See, this, if this can just be explained, I thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thanks, sir. Let me say we are fortunate that the rate for fun we have this season and this one. We have to honor it. Not all power. So we are fortunate. The first question is... they are really on the victory song. The first one, just to add in what the Honourable Member said on page 43 and 45 of of the annual report where I see a lot of non-performance. Now, you cannot target so many figures in a year, and then the outputs are zero, and then you say, hey, we've worked very well. And for us as parliamentarians, it's non-performance. I cannot sit here and say, black workers trained zero, females zero, disabled zero, young people unidentified zero, and then we say we are working. This is non-performance. But what explanation can be given? Secondly, is the cat skills in this sector where this theta is. I don't see it being specifically identified. You know, you have a cheetah that would have some cat skills that they would concentrate on. In the presentation, nothing was said about the cat skills to show that, you know, the country is moving towards this direction in achieving and addressing that. Adding to that question is, why do they have to invest late in training? We know that this deals with most cities, math and science subjects, but why do they have to wait until they get students that have got math and science? Why don't they start early to invest? Another question was on the issue of surplus. CFO was explaining that we have surpluses and then they use more money. I think Honorable Koloni covered it well. More especially administration. Why do you have a surplus? Because a surplus and a deficit is the same. Not correct to have a surplus. Much as it is not correct to have a deficit. So why can we pose and say, no, we have a surplus? Modestly, especially they say on administration saving. What can you save on administration? Which means you don't buy certain things that are needed by the administration, and then that are false performance. Or you don't fill in a position that is needed by the organization. So it's actually under expenditure. I noticed in the annual report that there was once a special investigation. And in the presentation, nothing was mentioned that there was one. You know, there wasn't an investigation. It was a special investigation. So we need a special presentation for that investigation. Why was there a special investigation, even though it was concluded? Also, the annual report on page 80, I wanted some meat on your special project. Why do you have to have this special project? What do you hope to achieve and what have you achieved, you know, in layman's language? Also on page 78, I noticed in your financial statement that even though I'll be making an application to work for this theater, that there are advances that are made to staff members. What are these advances for? So that when I'm also employed there, I know that I enjoy this benefit. Also on page 50 of the annual report, there is non-attendance of a board member, Mrs. Joubert. When was she actually appointed was it when she was appointed, there were no meetings before? I see that there's non-attendance to the meetings, and it is just really serving the board well. Thanks, Chair, for now.
What are you doing about this?
will be realized at the very end. And we also, I think the Honorable Gentleman from Thailand has also raised on the interest issue, but mine is also if you can tell us about the other issues, because it seems that it's only housing to 15% of the and you said in your presentation, push the women to Estonia. And then you had actually break down this woman from which province. And you had 3,000 Lennox involved. Where are the other names? What happened? And what do you do after those are those reports are what do you do? And maybe to also explain to say today you are presenting to the Select Council of the Committee, but also members of this committee are members of the Select Commission data. So you know you are dealing with two committees. So you are invited by the committee. So we want to call you, we want full information that we want to call you. So you can see us at least.
Thanks, Chair. I think we're quite aware that we are being engaged by members of both the Labour Portfolio Committee and the
Select.
Okay. Thanks for the correction. I think the questions between page 30 and page 43 where we want to go into the intent breakdown of the Labour tells us that we probably pitched our presentation not in the right particular manner, but I think we can provide those particular answers and so that the members are quite aware. I think, can I start with the first question on the challenges? What are the key challenges of the CETA? I think first, Chair, the CETA produces the annual financial report, but equally produces the sector skills plan, which is annually updated. And in that particular sector skills plan, which document can be forwarded to the select committee, one of the key things we are saying is that there are major transformational challenges for the sector. The sector is dominated and people of color are not properly represented in the sector. And we make that particular point in a very elaborated discussion. And what we are saying is that core on our mandate is to address that particular problem. One of the core areas of work in the sector is the role of artisans. And what we have picked up is that most of the artisans are 55 years and older and are white men. And one of the core challenges is to ensure that we change that particular landscape to ensure that there are new entrants into the sector and those new entrants represent the other marginalized groups in terms of the sector. That's the first core challenge. And if you look at the profile of most of our companies, the most publicly known, like the Sasol and the petroleum companies, you can see that particular scenario. And that's the one thing. The second thing with regard to the challenge is the fact that the prevalence of our company is mostly in metropolitan areas, and that is a very serious challenge. We are mostly represented in Gauteng, in KZN, in the Western Cape. Now, if you look at the breakdown of the Lena, you find that because the industrial density is more in the metropolitan area, we cannot account for learners in the other areas except for the metropolitan area. We do acknowledge that we do have a sprinkle of sand in the other areas, like for instance in the Eastern Cape and area called Berlin, we do have one or two firms. But we're talking about the agencies where the majority of our companies are. And the tendency of our company is rather to play where there is a high density of the learners. And that tendency is brought about the fact that to establish providers where there is not a very broad representation of learners becomes a very a serious challenge for the company. Now, they cannot set up those institutions. But it doesn't mean that we don't have learners from those provinces. But what it means is that the learners from Mpumalanga, for instance, in Mpumalanga, our largest two factories, number one, is synthetic brand two of it is in Sekunda and Mpumalanga, called Sasol Synthetic Fuels in common terms, but I mean the registered name. The one I said before. Second one is Sasol Chemical Industries, Sasol there. And in fact, we're supposed to account for those two as the major sources of learners. But those learners are accounted for as in Gauteng because the head offices of those two companies happen to be situated in Gauteng. And that's the dilemma. And if we break down these numbers of learners per company, you would clearly see that there is a breakdown that talks to most of the provinces. But we have to admit, we have very little learners, except for learners who come from the National Skills Fund, from Limpopo. In fact, I think we've got about 14 learners from a company called Mawasha Chemicals in Kuruba. We have absolutely no learners, and we've got a few companies in the Northern Cape. The regional manager of the Western Cape is also here. Because in most instances, the Northern Cape is comprised of companies who are small, who do not participate in the skills development strategy. So that is the challenge. I think I was trying to elaborate on the second challenge, because members want to know what are our challenges in terms of... And I think the other challenge, which is an issue that I think Barak is going to talk to in detail, is the issue around the financial allocation. And I'm not going to speak to that, and I think Farah must speak to that in much more serious detail. If I can proceed, Che, I'm still mindful that the questions at pages 30 to 43 are not yet answered. And, but the other issue that was the question of the scarce and critical skills. That our report and our presentation doesn't seem to speak to the scarce and the critical skills. And I think it might be in terms of the pitching of the presentation and omission, but we do have substantive work around the scarce and critical skills. We just completed work for the sector skills plan, where we have a 50-page report where we detail what are the areas of scarcity of our skills. And most of the areas of scarcity are areas around operations. Your technicians, your riggers, your welders, and all of those particular technical skills are identified in that particular report. The annual financial report basically says what has been our performance, but it doesn't focus entirely on the skills and technical skills. We can provide detailed information around that particular piece of work, and that particular information will give you a sense. But again, if you look at the grant provision, the discretionary grant provision per se, not the mandatory grant provision, since the grants are divided into two. The discretionary grant provision, the core criteria of that provision is the scarce and critical skills. So we do not provide grants up until the particular applicant indicates that we are now training people who are scarce in the sector, people who are critical for their productions in the sector, and that is the core criteria of the award of the discretionary grant. So, in terms of our presentation, but however, we have not focused entirely as to what is the work, but and also we've not said what is the core criteria around the presentation of those particular grants. is difficult, honorable members, for us to answer the questions of both non-attendants, but I'm sure Farah can give us some particular background. Because if you look at the structure, the teacher office reports to the board, and the board, these are constituency representatives that come to represent the different constituencies. The two primary constituencies are labor and business, and these are the ones that appoint those particular members onto the board. But I'm sure we can give the actual statistics as to when a particular member did not attend, and if there is a provision of an apology as to what was the nature of that non-attendance. I think it does deal with also the question of the other provincial statistics, because I think a part of the bigger question was, why do we not have statistics for the other provinces? And I tried to speak to that, that we have this particular challenge. And the question around the 50 women in consortium economics, the program that we have supported with the South African Petroleum Industries Association, which is up here. In terms of that particular project, we have supported 50 women, and those 50 women are in management positions. And the project hopes to encourage transformation in the petroleum sector by training 50 women on a two-year cycle on management skills, leadership skills. And those people are trained on a program equivalent to the management advancement program with the business school at Rice University. And so while the numbers are rather too little compared to the total output or total sector numbers, but in terms of trying to change the complexion of leadership and management in the petroleum subsector out of the 9 subsectors, I think it is some degree of a movement. And just to say that the figure, the actual figures of that particular project is way above the actual figure, I don't know. 50, so I'm saying the actual figure, financial figure. Yeah, 1.3 million. So you can easily see that out of the total income, I mean the financial structure of the organization, a substantial amount of money is being plowed to that particular project. I know that the numbers do not sound significant, but it's a high-level project and it can cost a high amount of money. Maybe I can pause and ask the colleagues to answer some of the other questions, especially the questions around the financial test and then again the learner breakdown. Thank you.
In terms of the challenges, I just want to start there because Bhakti has alluded to the non-financial areas of the challenges. I think as a speaker, we have major challenges in terms of financial issues, and this is due to legislation that exists within a CETA, as well as the manner in which our levies are handled, the processes that start as the principal receiver of revenue, collects the levy for the CETA. And this is not unique to the CETA, but it goes across all CETAs. The issue is that the levy income received takes at least 3 months before we receive it. So that's a major delay in terms of receiving levy income, and therefore this 3 month levy income that is received late is held by SARS and then passed over to the Department of Labor. And we then have to await, we have a 3 month lag in terms of all of our operational processes. this can also lead to issues of substances that come through. That's just one of the challenges. The other issue around the levies is that SARS have made numerous adjustments and errors in their capturing of our levies. And it's an issue of what we call SARS retrospective adjustments. In terms of all CSARS, the retrospective adjustment figures of these errors that are being made and adjusted subsequently leads to substantial amounts of money which is allocated to wrong CSAR or not paid over to a CSAR. Hence, we have to manage a fully fledged debtors and creditors system on a daily basis in CSAR to ensure that our revenue is actually complete. We sort of have a backup system of SARS in terms of asking our member companies to give us EMP 201, which is a SARS document in which they call the ESPL levy, in order for us to reconcile and balance, because we find that what SARS tells us and what the company tells us is two different stories. So we effectively have to maintain a fully fledged debtors and creditors system on a daily basis and track each and every company, which has been a major challenge, and that's across all sectors. I think another major area of problem is the delays that we experience in terms of the implementation of the discretionary grant contract. While we've allocated a large amount to discretionary grants, we find that these contracts do not deliver in time on the time frame that is expected. And we set out to set up contracts on an annual basis, such as a learnership, which is normally a 12-month period. But we find that these processes take 2 to 3 years, and therefore there's a major lag in that whole discretionary grant cycle. I think another last financial major challenge I would highlight is the sort of a focused and proactive cash flow management. Again, this touches on the issue of surpluses, and I'm going to answer that question in detail. A CSA receiving money for in a sense is held in trust for skills development. We cannot receive and pay out money because training cycles are occurring and there's certain mandatory documents that need to be submitted before that there's a legislative claim or an obligation for a CSA to pay out. Hence, by nature, a CSA will carry a surplus of a minimum of at least 3 to 6 months levy income. And that is accepted even by the legislation and the Department of Labor. I think those are some of the financial challenges. In fact, I've tried to highlight those more important ones. In terms of the second question around the clean bill of health and the in terms of rollovers on the in terms of the audit report, I think that in terms of the CSA environment, as I mentioned, the funds are received from member companies. We then put these funds or allocate them into the relevant area. Now, in the CSA, we have the mandatory grants, the discretionary grants, and the administration. Those are the three major areas that are legislated and where we need to allocate funds. In terms of, we have annually applied to Treasury. In fact, Treasury has given all CSAs an exemption from rollover since 2005. The reason being that by nature of the organization, funds are held in trust either in mandatory or discretionary reserves, awaiting training cycles to expire and awaiting certain mandatory or discretionary contractual obligation to pass before payment can occur. So I think that's probably something that is inherent from a legislative framework of CSA. However, in terms of the technical CSA, if I refer you back to that graph that I spoke about and the 133% that we paid out in year 2006, what has happened is that for the first NSDS cycle, we collected what had happened is that the first 5 years of the NSDS cycle, we collected large sums of revenue and participation level steadily increased from member companies over those years. So in fact, the surplus or the money that we had is actually money that were non-participation of members or unpaying them. Now, we are fortunate, I think, as the chemical sector, we have an extremely high participation rate. And the unclaimed surplus is a very small amount. You can see it's well over 80s, going into 90s and 100% of payment rate. So effectively, the surplus is that difference between what we have received and what we have paid out. And we are quite fortunate, as I mentioned. We've achieved, I think, the highest rate of all CETAs over the last 5 or 6 years in terms of grant disbursement. But the reality is that a surplus will exist in each and every CETA because of that unclaimed portion. Now, those surpluses are transferred annually into a fund which is called the discretionary grant fund. Now, that discretionary grant fund is utilized at the discretion of the CETA, at the board of the CETA, to allocate those funds for discretionary projects and for sector priorities. So, again, I'm going to touch on the question on the project, because the funding in the discretionary reserve is any unclaimed grants, any admin savings, as I mentioned, and that is moved over and at the discretion allocated. Now, that process is done annually, and there's a one cycle each year. But annually, for the 12-month period before the cycle comes, there would be an accumulation of such surpluses in that reserve, because we want to allocate as much as possible to the sector annually. So the question of rollovers really is not an issue within, it's an issue inherent in legislation that we have overcome now with via discussions with Treasury and the AGM, and it is a view that in order to operate optimally and efficiently, we need to get those cycles 100% so that the surpluses are minimized at any point in time.
I think my colleague has alluded to the questions on page 32 through 45, and we'll come back to that. I just want to mention, my colleague has also mentioned around the scarce skills. The CETA has done large amounts of work in this particular area. We, as we say, we have a sector skills plan, which is then filtered into a scarce and critical skills matrix. We use this is a document which is very substantive and goes through each and every career and qualification within the chemical industry and highlights the particular scarce areas. We then focus on these scarce areas and we prioritize these either for the purposes of projects and for discretionary grants. Now that discretionary grant review cycle and the allocation of approved discretionary grants is based on that scarce and critical skills matrix. That is the fundamental document utilized in allocation.
There was a question around the learners being brought in at a much younger age, earlier than just waiting for these learners to come through the tertiary education. The CETA has in the past, not in this particular year, but in prior years, we've had various bridging programs, which were for school leavers. We also had a program where we took, 60 young girls from Standard 9 and Standard 10 Metric on a science and engineering camp. And that was a year program. And the idea was to promote young women into the chemical industries and bring them in and to focus on particularly on math and science at the secondary level. And those particular learners have been extremely successful and now are now studying further in chemical engineering and those areas. And I think that was an extremely successful project. So that's just one of the examples. Although it wasn't this year, it was in the prior years and the results of we're now bearing the fruits of that. The question on admin savings and on surpluses again, this is a very unique situation to the CETA environment. The CETA is legislated by the Skills Development Act, and the Act requires that certain percentages of our money that we receive are allocated in different areas. Now, the of the
of the money we receive, we receive 80% of the skills development levy and 20% goes to the National Skills Authority. The 80% that we receive is broken down into 50% of it goes for mandatory grants, 20% goes for discretionary grants, and 10% must be used for admin. Now, the legislation is clear that a maximum, absolute maximum of 10% of the money that you receive can be used for administration purposes. So, the problem is once you go over that 10%, the CETA is seen to be financially non-viable. And that is a serious problem in terms of legislation. It also results in an immediate qualification in your audit report. In terms of the 2006-2007 year, we budgeted for approximately an 8 to 9% increase in levy income. However, as I've shown earlier in the slide, we actually received an 18% increase in skill development levy income, and this was due to operational efficiencies of recovering into CETA monies, liaising with staff and recovering creditors or the adjustments that I spoke about, the underpayments. Now, based on that, the 10% admin was much higher than we actually anticipated. In terms of our budget, we had spent all the monies as per budget. However, we received much more. And therefore, that resulted in an admin saving. Now, I would just, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, as well as the legislation that governs departments and constitutional institutions, yes, I would fully agree that where there's an underspending, it is an issue. It is deemed to be non-attainment of objectives. However, in a CETA environment, where you have a 10%, that's the maximum you can spend on admin, letting go salaries, all your admin costs, and you make a saving out of that, saving is due to further enhancing operational efficiency. Because it's so limited and so small, and you've got to have plans beforehand. For example, last year and this current year, we introduced, in terms of our procurement system, we had a target of saving 1.5 million. And how we did that was, we negotiated better contracts with our providers. For example, we negotiated an agreement with SAA, which is called the SKIMS program. That in itself, where we get the most cheapest flight and we book well in advance and we plan much better, it results in a saving of 600,000 just on that one line item. Now, the reason for the saving is that in admin, it's a positive in a CETA environment because that money goes back to the sector and is used for skills development. So it goes back as discretionary grant and comes back into the sector and is used for sector skills priorities. So, from a CETA point of view, a saving on the 10% admin is a very positive thing. Many of the CETAs cannot survive on that 10% due to the nature of their debt and the size, and those CETAs are having major issues with the Department of Labor, with the authorities, and they're not viable in terms of the Skills Development Act. So from the point of a CETA environment, specifically in terms of the legislation, I think the CETA, if we can save anything on admin, is very positive. As I mentioned, the total budget was spent, however, the income was much higher and we had also achieved this. So effectively, what I'm saying is that there are no real surpluses because the money is swept into the discretionary fund and allocated to sector skills projects. Now, the National Skills Authority, or the NSA, works on the principle that they don't give you funding if you have any surplus. Our CETA, the chemical CETA, has been allocated funding annually, every single year for the last 5 years, on the National Skills Fund. And the reason is that we have proven successfully that we do not have surpluses and all our funds are actually committed. And our actual surplus is really very minimal. It is zero or minimal. So that's really we ascribe and we believe is the best possible financial plan. There was a question on the special investigation, and I was expecting this question. In terms of the Auditor General's report, there was in other matters they reported that there was a special investigation, and this is due to the fact that the Auditor General is
has a responsibility and obligation in terms of the new reporting framework to report on these kind of issues. The reason for the special investigation, there was what we call a banking scam, which we found done on the Chita during the financial year. This particular scam, and I think if we might have read about a similar kind of scams in the papers where these syndicates use companies such as Telkom and say Sark, and they perpetrate to deposit a check into an account, and it clears, and then as Telkom and say has deposited money into your account, and erroneously they owe you a refund, and we now require you to pay us back this money. When in actual fact, it's actually a check deposited somewhere with a different name, and the bank is normally involved in these kind of scams. However, there was an amount of 80,000 that was requested as a refund, and we had checked the bank account, and the money was there, it had cleared, and we believe the Telkom and they had actually. However, this money was fully recovered. We lodged a claim on the bank, and we lodged the claim, and we said that the bank was negligent in terms of the whole scam because of the fact that there was no someone within the bank had put in the deposit as though it was looked at Telkom and say they had sent us an EFT. The bank then refunded us the full amount of the loss. So effectively there was no loss, and that's clear in the Auditor General's report. They also say that the money was fully recovered and there was no loss to Cheetah. I think the proactive nature and the manner in which we had handled it, we had identified within a day that there was a problem. We then froze all the bank accounts. We recovered a portion that was from the frozen account, and we then later plugged the claim against the bank, and we requested, in terms of the PFMA, our duty was then also to request an investigation, and that was done. And the investigation focused on internal controls and whether there was a system of control breakdown. So there was actually no loss and everything was recovered. And the report obviously focused on the control side of financial control. There was a question around advances to employees and what are they. In terms of the Cheetah human resource policy, there is a provision for advances to employees. However, the provision reads as a method, an employee can get a maximum of 50% of his salary, that's the net salary, his or her salary as an advance, and that is then must be paid back in the following month. So that is allowed in terms of the human resource policy. So the risk is very limited because effectively it can be taken in the month where you've already worked half, with a certain number of days. So it's actually already owed you in a sense, but it must be recovered in the next month. So there's no real major risk in terms. Secondly, we link the provident funds of all employees to these advances. So, the risk is minimal, and if anything has to happen, we recover it directly from the provident fund. As you can see, the amount of the advances is very small in the annual report, and that represents the financial year end. I think that was the month of March where there were some advances which are allocated. The question on page 50, which relates to the non-attendance of Mrs. L. Duberne. This is specifically referring to the subcommittee of the board, or one of the board subcommittees, that is the Cheetah Audit Committee. Mrs. L. Duberne was only appointed to the committee at the end of November 2008. 2006.
So effectively, she then could only attend the one meeting of the year, which was in February. However, she did not attend that meeting because she was she got married, and she went on at that time. So effectively, if you see this, the first line there, it says Mr. T. Robert resigned on the 16th of 11, 2006. So Mr. Baird was appointed in place of Mr. T. Robert. As you can see, Mr. C. Robert attended the meeting on the 16th, and then he emigrated to Australia, and his replacement was then nominated as Mr. Brad. So effectively, she only joined at the last, towards the end of the year, and could have only attended one meeting. And the one meeting that was left for the year, obviously she did not, because of those reasons. She had tendered her apologies and explained. However, Mr. Bhatt is now a very functional member and has attended all meetings after that.
I think I've covered most of the financial related questions. I'm going to just hand you back to Bhakti.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chet. Chet, just in terms of the letter question, and again, I was almost caught by surprise by the member's question, because it's a glaring problem. But I think the slide of the success indicator should be read in full, and I have read them in full. And what the slide means is that what it says is annual target, the enrollment sometimes happened before and get accounted later, because if you look at the from 2.8, and I think 2.8 is much more clear, including 4.1, which is the number of unemployed people who have entered the learning program, what you will see as a disparity, that what is the previous disparity is that you have low completion and high target. On the other one, you've got high completion and low target. I'm not sure whether that is clear. 2.8, it's number page 44. If you look, you read the page 44, 2.8, number of workers that have entered the learning program. The MOU target is 1,000. The achievement for the year is 2,369. What it means is that these registrations happened long before, because most of the learners on the learnership program are not on a year-to-year program. They are on three-year program, and we find them as such. We don't find them on a year-to-year program. The danger with year-to-year funding is that there is no commitment on those particular funds, and then they cannot proceed. So the numbers of the other areas, there is a serious discrepancy between the target and the achievement. But what I'm trying to say is that is because the sum of the numbers which are supposed to be registered in that particular year have been registered before, and that is demonstrated from 2.8, where you look at the completion against the registration. I think it's very abnormal that you have a target of 1,000 and you complete 2,369. I'm not sure in percentage terms what exactly it means. I mean, 4.1 is also glaring, where unemployed people that have completed learning programs are 1,039 out of a target of 5,078. So that is the actual reason why you find, that is the one reason. The second reason is that we still do have serious challenges of employment equity in terms of the registration of learners. And we fight with our companies on a year-to-year basis around those employment equity challenges. There still is a view and a perception in the sector, most prevalent in the petroleum sector, I can say it very openly here, that some of the positions in the petroleum sub-sector are not meant for women folks. In the nature and the structure of the operation. And they also raised in some particular instance health and safety consideration and a variety of other considerations. It's not that the teacher buys into that particular agenda. The teacher has been in very serious debate with those particular companies on those issues. And one of the big approach to them is, we do not grant you grants, discretionary grants, which we have the final discretion on, if your registrations are not in line with the employment equity consideration. But you can use your own funds. But with our funds, you're not going to get those particular grants. And we make it very clear. And each and every year, we have debates and debates with our companies, because our companies are struggling to internalize it. And we're saying to them quite clearly, we're not going to give you grants because you're not playing according to the rules of the game. The mandatory grant rules are quite clear. And that the areas of training must be either cared for critical for the operation, and they must conform with the employment equity criteria. It's not a cumulative confirmation, it's a mass confirmation. So 85% of the learners should be black, 54% should be women. There is a big problem in achieving the disability target. I must be open with you. And one of the problems is that the operations sometimes do not allow for disabled people to come through the operations and work. Unless, for instance, if you're talking about process controllers are those technical experts who work in large continuous production operations, who are looking at the computerized program and see through the program from time to time and see how the operations perform and correct accordingly. But in other operations where people go through the scaffolds, and it is difficult, almost impossible to place disabled learners. But what we have endeavored to do as a city is that we have not bought into the agenda of companies to say there is a gender consideration to those particular positions. But I think, and then also if you look at the structure of our providers, in terms of disability, there is still a big challenge in accommodating disabled learners onto a variety of programs. And I'm talking about disability programs. If you look at the facility to ensure that blind people, great facility for blind people, almost non-existent. And that is a very serious challenge. Facilities in the provider institutions for disabled people, almost non-existent. And we do have that particular scenario in a very large number of our operations and our providers. But I think the broader question around the target is that we are not having targets for the sake of targets. We do, if you calculate the achievements against the target, you'll see that we are way above our learner target. That's number one. Number two, if you calculate the cumulative numbers in terms of the areas or the categories, you will also see that we are above. The one area that I must admit we are not about is 1.2. Number of SDS trained, the target is 250. Achievement is 152. We've not made 250 because we've been in discussion with the Department of Labor. The department does not think that to fulfill service level agreement 1.2, we need to train SDS. So it means we've had to change in terms of what we were doing against what the Department of Labor has since advised us. So it means a program was aborted before completion on 1.2. So we don't say SDS. According to the discussion with the Department of Labor, we need to ensure that our sector skills plan is aggregated into a sector guide. And that sector guide, we have 250 specialists in the sector who are trained on the sector guide. And the guide is distributed to learners, not trained SDS. And that's why you see that the figures, and then there is nowhere else where we report on those particular figures of the SDS and how we've moved on the figures of the SDS. And that's in line with the question of the learners and why the breakdown and why the figures are less than what we had planned for. The other question was the question around the investment in education and training. why they make investments. Farah tried to speak about it. We've had a project called the SAFTA project. And that project, SAFTA is an institution which relates to the Department of Science and Technology. And they, National Research Foundation, they are out in that particular organization. And their intention is to upgrade the levels of math and science, and we as the clinical sector are very interested in that project. But one of the problems of the heads of the sector is their ability to comprehend and also get good symbols in math and science at a particular rate that allow you entrance into the chemical industry. So we've been in partnership with that particular organization, but I did say that we had discussions with them before. We've since commenced on the new discussion for the new funding cycle, which is the current year. There are two things we are concerned with this project. This project addresses learners, and we think that the numbers we're talking to are insignificant. We rather address the actual educators, because we think, through the various reports that we've received from the Department of Education, the problem is not the learners. The problem is the skills upgrading of the educators. So what we've agreed with SAFTA is that the intervention going forward, this year is the last year when we're completing an engagement with learners. It involves school camps, it involves study groupings, it involves going out with a select number of group of learners. It starts from a grade 10 and it goes up until grade 12. And then there is a pause year. We are in the pause year in the last reporting year. We're starting again this year. That's how the project is structured. But when we came to SAFTA and we've agreed with them, we had a meeting with them already. I think it was around June. Where we agreed that we are now going to focus on the skills upgrading of the educators, not the learners. But when you upgrade the skills of the educators, we can make sure that we reach out to as many learners as possible and not limit ourselves to the limited number of learners. On that particular project, given the interest of the breakdown, of the provincial breakdown, in that project, we have only concentrated in the Eastern Cape and the Free State as a start. Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, the Free State, and Limpopo as a start. So you can be rest assured that even on that project, we are quite careful around the geographic spread of our learners. But the idea is that we need to spread this particular project to all centers and make sure that there is good chemistry training at those particular levels. We cannot afford to invest later. But by the time we intervene, those learners have not had a very profound platform or a breakdown to enter the chemical industry. I'm sure I've exhausted most of the questions, but there was a particular question on page 17 of the skilled workers. And I think that question sought the understanding which are those particular skilled workers. What we say is that the skilled workers are those workers that we're funding largely through our leadership project. And what we're reporting on page 17 is that while it has been an approach on leadership training for the skilled workers, we are now converting them to apprenticeship training. Because apprenticeship training is a skills-based training. It's more short-term. It's not as long-term as the apprenticeship route. And those skills areas are the same areas which are the focus areas of the discretionary grant. And there was a particular question as to what exactly do we mean with those particular skilled workers and what are the skilled areas. Last question, Chair. There's a question as well which was related to the financial saying, what are your special projects? And Farah did report on those particular special projects. And I'm not sure what page they are on. They are on Derek Pio's section. Page. Let me quickly go through those particular projects. I know that Arendt is one of them.
But I will
talk to them. Thanks.
Sorry, I wanted to do a follow-up. Okay.
Yes.
I want to present, without stating that we have an annual report in front of us, and an annual report really means an annual report, which means 12 months, 365 days. And in a strategic plan, if you say you're going to do this this year, if you say you're going to have 250 SDF, you just mean in that year. So the explanation that is given that black workers 101 is what we are going to do this year. We're not saying, you know, midterm or in 3 years or what. This year. So not unless this report is incorrect, it should add another column that would say out of this 111, other learners are in the process, or other employees are in the process, but this year there is nothing. But as it stands, it says this year we'll train 111, and the year has ended, we haven't trained that 111. I think that's the essence of the report. But what is good about the report is that it's just specific. So it's unlike reading a Bible. You can read one line and then preach or say, this deals with the year. So I'm not really with these figures. I'm not comfortable. Not unless they really redo. Because we take these things so that when we go to our constituency, then we tell them, no, this teacher is going to train so much this year. But you cannot explain how much they have trained this year. So it must appear. The correct figures must appear.
Just to answer the previous question on the project, if we go to page 83, on page 83 of the annual report, there's a comprehensive list of all the projects that the CHIT has undertaken for the year. I think that basically answers the question. It also shows the amount of money spent on each and every project and amounts approved by the board and utilized during the year. It's really quite a comprehensive list. Also, Mr. Chair, I also want to touch on the question that Bhakti was did allude to around, also on the target, and specifically on habits. I think the honorable member did refer to target 2.7 on habits, where the numbers show zero on that last column. The issue of habit is a challenge to us, and I'll explain why. In terms of the various surveys done on the chemical industry sector, and by nature of the careers and the work jobs in the chemical industry sector, the survey has said that over 95 to 98% of the sector were already way above the habit level 1. Which leaves very little scope for training on the remainder of the area. The numbers that are left, especially on the ABET levels 1 and 2, are very small. And by nature of the chemical industry, the entry requirement for jobs in the chemical industry are generally fixed at ABET level 4. So what you'll find is that as you go down the page and you look at effort levels 2, 3, and going on to 4, you'll see that there are much higher achievements there. But the effort level 1 definitely continues to be a challenge because the entry level is much higher than that within the sector. Thank you.
Follow up on the special project. On page 80 of the annual report, there is this mention of special project, you know, item 14. It does show whether it's 25 million or 25,000 or 25 rand received during the year. Then when you go down for this year, then you see other projects, nothing written. Bridging project, HIV project, RPLS, and project. These are actually the special projects that I was actually referring to and speaking to the initial final statement that they could put some meat on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable Member, there is a different split between, there's a very big difference between the project mentioned on page 18 and the project, the overall CETA project listed on page 83. The project on page 80 is a very specific project which relates to the National Skills Fund. It's actually donor, it's funding received from the National Skills Fund, which has certain conditions that must be met. It's a contractual agreement to do certain things. Now, where you see the Abbott project and the bridging and all of those, these were projects that were undertaken in prior years. And the NSF requires us to report comprehensively on all projects where those NSF funding was spent. So this is really donor funding of 25 million, and we've spent in the region of 19.7 million on that during the year. So in this current year, we spend money on RPL, SME, provider project, and learner allowance. And these were the contractual agreements for the 2006-2007 year. And if you don't, the NSA has a rule that if you don't use these monies as per the condition, then that money is payable back and they would not forward you any further tranches. So effectively, this is donor funding on special conditions. So there's a split between CHITA project and special NSA or NSF funded project, and these are the NSF projects.
I just want to, before I ask this question on page 39, I want to support my colleague on the work committee that when we say C number, we see numbers, and when we see zero, we say C zero. But I want to add also that we see the areas where a target is lower than the outcomes, and then the outcome is higher. Maybe it's just a way to make up for the zeros, where there are efforts to add more learners there. Then on page 29, it says there that it is contributing to sustainable development. Now, when it comes down to just on top of, no, just below the SMME on point 2, it means that overriding purpose was to ensure that learners and SMMEs were not left in the lurch once the learning level is completed and the provider withdraws. Now, we understand because it has been explained that it is a three-year cycle, so of course the finances are there. But now, when the provider withdraws, how is the new provider, how do you bring in a new provider, or how do you fill this gap that the learner or the SME is not left in the lurch? The finances are there, I understand, according to the three-year cycle. But now, the provider withdraws, what do we do in that situation? Thank you very much.
I just in page 41, we are told then that there is a problem in terms of shortage of
Madam Chair, I think perhaps more in the right direction for this one.
Thanks, Chair.
Just on page 41, the question around the staff and the shortcomings with regards to research consultants. I think the problem in the sector is also not necessarily of the lack of skills. The problem is the problem of coordination of the work of the various institutions. And what we're trying to say there is that while if we've relied on short-term consulting to fill the gap of research, we would want to house those research skills within the organization. But, Chair, given the 10% admin cap, it is difficult and almost impossible to house those particular skills within the organization. The sector skills plan is submitted once every 5 years. And once every year, we need to update it. What therefore this means is that the research team gets active in particular months of the year, of the 1 year, and continuously then goes back to the constituencies to consult on the research information. It keeps them not very active, number one. It keeps them less and less in touch with the other sector, research agenda and research issues. But given the 10% cap, we're not able to pay almost your top level researchers in terms of the teams. Remember, researchers would normally operate rather in teams than in individuals running through research agendas and research programs. And that is what we are trying to address in this particular paragraph. But in terms of the strategic plan and the new structure that we've now set up, we have set up to ensure that there is a research manager who is from time to time provided for resources to do appointments on short-term research consultants. Because what we also pick up is that we can only get those consultants on various short terms, and we can't get them for longer terms. And we think sometimes they are more objective if they come in as consultants, or rather than come in full time. So the research agenda and how we play our work to address that particular agenda is very critical, because the primary task of the CTA is to ensure that we understand the profile of the sector, we provide for advice with respect to the planning around the addressing of the scarce and critical skills provided for in the profile. That's the primary agenda of the CTA. And if we cannot provide the critical information and we cannot provide expertise with regard to the critical information, that would be a challenge. And that's what we were trying to explain with regard to that particular paragraph in the annual report. But research is going to be a challenge. One of the ways of addressing this particular challenge is we've now started the process of not conducting research programs alone. Our sector skills plan, which has currently been provided for the Department of Labor and approved, was presented to NEDLAC in about September 2005 for the period after September 2005. And that particular SSP, sector skills plan, was done in consultation with the Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Minerals and Energy, Human Science Research Council, because we then understood that the core problem of our SSP of 2000 to 2005 was that it was a single band sector skills plan. It focused only and purely on chemicals operations informed by the chemical leader. And we then did an about 10 in 2004 for the current SSP, which is on the table. And we think that through the partnership, the research agenda is much more fulfilled if you have problems of resources. And this is what we're trying to speak to on that particular paragraph of the annual report.
I just also want to touch on or expand on what Dr. said around the research. We found that over the years, in our business plan when evaluating the nature of the research element that it was not a function that was required to be full-time. We found it to be quite seasonal in nature. The fact that mandating grants come in, for example, by legislation on a certain date, that's the 30th June of each financial year. And that is the point when there's a whole lot of capturing and info is then put together, and then you need to do certain research around that. So there were high periods of research and very low periods where we would not need much services around research. And we therefore decided to strategically look at other options. And Bhakti has mentioned some of them. I mean, we also went into possible partnerships with companies such as SAS-SA and all the other research institutions. So in that way, we did not expend the large amounts of money, and we tapped into resources and to areas that already were existing research that was available. The DOL also has a large amount of research, and we tapped into those partnerships. So I think it was a change of the method of the way research was being done and the way we look at it. On page 29, the question was around the learners and the SMEs and what do we do when the provider withdraws. I think the issue, there might be two sides to this question if I understand it correctly. And one is what do we do when a provider withdraws while there's a contractual obligation, and the other one, and I think more specific to what's been said on page 29, is once the program is completed. The CETA has a very strong system of contractual management, and we enforce these contractual obligations upon the providers, and we set up these contracts up front and agree upon them. Where there is non-delivery or where a contractor withdraws in the middle of a project or in the middle of a training program, we then have recourse via those contractual obligations and legal recourse. We have not achieved and incurred any losses of this nature, and we've ensured it that based on the contracts and the way they are written, we are focused largely on this, and we get legal opinion at least annually to ensure that the contracts are worded correctly. I think once the program is completed, and what's trying to be said here in this particular narrative, is that we feel, as CETA, that we need to develop and we need to consistently manage a fully fledged tracking system of each and every learner that comes onto that goes through learning programs and comes onto the CETA database. And this will have numerous benefits. So this is the idea that we want to keep a track and manage a database of each and every learner in the chemical industry. Now, that is the idea of not leaving the learner in a lurch. And also to look at these learners going forward in terms of their career development. So if the fully fledged tracking system is being maintained and we are developing that continuously, and I think that will emanate a large amount of benefits going into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've come to the end of our meeting. If there are no questions, I see no hands. I would like to thank you very much for the presentation. The report, because of the